Good afternoon. The technology is working. So if we could have people close the doors, we'll get started here. You're all gluttons for punishment. It's been a long day, but I very much appreciate your being here, and I'm honored that Aspen Institute would have me come make this presentation. I've made it to a number of people in different circumstances and gotten some very interesting reactions. I'm involved in a group called the Transatlantic Policy Network, and I said to them as they were putting together their agenda, you should spend some time on demographics, and made this presentation, portions of this. There's some that are here that I have done just for Aspen that I've not used before. And they came back to me and they said, frankly, we looked at this just to be polite. We figured, okay, Senator Bennett wants us to look at this and we better humor him and go through the motions. And we've now realized that demographics impacts everything we're talking about and everything we have been looking at. All of our task forces have had to rethink and recalibrate all of the things that they're doing based on the impact of demographics. The second major point I need to make before I start has to do with the statistics we're going to go through. There's only one thing I'm absolutely sure about them all. They're all wrong. Well, not the ones that are past, but the ones that are future. I learned that when I went to the Senate, that virtually every projection that is made there is wrong. I don't know in advance whether they're wrong on the high side or the low side. All I know is that they are wrong. And we see that in the debates about the budget. The deficit is forecast at the beginning of the year, and it never comes out to be what is forecast even at the beginning of the year. The current deficit, for example, was forecast to be close to $400 billion in fiscal 2006. Fiscal 2006 will end in about 60 days, and in all probability, the deficit will be less than $300 billion. But that's the challenge that you have. We have a methodology for making forecasts. It's the best methodology we can put together. But the world is so unpredictable that the forecasts never, ever turn out to be right. So when I say demography is destiny, it's only destiny for about the next 10 years. And after that, you begin to guess. Now, the guesses may be pretty good, and demographic trends are very hard to change, but they can change. So I'm making this disclaimer right up front that while we have gone to the very best sources we can find in order to come up with these numbers, that doesn't mean the farther out you go, that the numbers are absolute. Nonetheless, I think the farther out we go, there's still a pretty good indication of what's going to happen. So with that disclaimer, let's get into this. And I start out not with demographic numbers, but with some past history on the U.S. budget, because while we're going to end up in the world, we'll start out in this country. This is a chart showing the components of federal spending in fiscal year 1966. The red is the mandatory spending. By mandatory, I mean Congress has decreed that money will be spent on these programs whether we have it or not. And whether Congress could repeal it, but this is not subject to the appropriations process. Mandatory spending does not come to us for us to say, well, we will appropriate X amount of money for this, that, and the other. And the mandatory shown here is predominantly Social Security. Social Security is on autopilot. We spend according to the Social Security formula, and the money is not appropriated. The money just flows automatically out of the Treasury. So mandatory spending was 26%. Interest costs, interest on the national debt, was 7% of the total federal spending. Non-defense discretionary spending, 23% That's the light blue. And the big gorilla in the room is defense. The dark blue is defense spending. Now, you might ask, why do I pick as a starting year 1966? That's the year the Congress passed Medicare. All right, here's fiscal 2005. Mandatory spending has grown to 56%. Interest cost remains exactly the same percentage of the federal budget as it was. Interest costs, by the way, are mandatory as well. You have to pay the interest on the bonds or you default. And we have not defaulted since the days of Alexander Hamilton, and we won't in the future. So if you put the two together, you're over 60% now that the Congress has no control over. Defense has shrunk to 20%, virtually identical with non-defense discretionary spending, which is 19%. So that's everything else. That's the national parks. That's the highways. That's education. That's everything else that we do in government, 19%. Let's look ahead with a projection just 10 years. Mandatory has now grown to 60%. Interest costs have gone up to 9%. Non-defense discretionary has shrunk to 15%, and the defense has shrunk to 16%. And if we were to go out farther years, I call these the Pac-Man charts, because the big red on the end is going to eat everything else. Let's take the General Accounting Office. Let's put it in a different sense. The horizontal bar is current revenue. And these are measured not in absolute dollars. These are measured the only way that makes sense, which is percentage of GDP. Because as the economy grows, the dollars will go up, but the only way you can really have any sort of benchmark is to say, yes, or how are they going up with respect to this, the growth of the economy? So right now, current revenue is at 18.5% of GDP, which is historic norm. The federal revenues come in somewhere in a band between 18 and 19% of GDP. Occasionally, they get outside of the band during the dot-com bubble at the end of the 1990s. We had tremendous capital gains realizations coming in as the dot-com millionaires cashed in on their stock. The Congress cut the capital gains tax rate as an incentive for them to cash in on their stock, and we got up to 22% of GDP coming in. Then 9/11 hit, the recession hit, everything created a perfect storm, and revenues fell to 16.5% of GDP. As the recovery has taken hold, we're back up to 18.5%, which is right in historic norms. Now, you see the same numbers that we had in the pie chart there in 2005, only this time they're in a bar chart. And as you can see, spending is above revenues, which will add to the deficit, which means you will see an increase in the debt pattern. But mandatory spending is now broken down. Social Security is in the red. Medicare is in the blue. Medicaid is in the green. And the light blue, I can't read from here. Just a minute. Okay. There's the interest in the light blue. And everything else is in the purple. And again, that's split about 50-50 between defense and discretionary. All right. Going out 10 years with that Pac-Man chart we showed before, you see Social Security remains about the same, up a little. Medicare is up a little. Medicare is up a little. And now the interest starts to bite. You go out to 2025, Social Security is up, Medicare is up dramatically, Medicaid about the same. Now the interest, that takes you right up to your level of revenue so that everything else of government has to be borrowed. You go out to 2035, Social Security's growth has kind of leveled off, Medicare growth inexorably going up, Medicaid about the same, and you see that that is totally unsustainable by the time you get to 2045. The entire federal budget is taken up in three programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and everything else is borrowed. Now, obviously, that's unsustainable, and as I think it's Herb Stein, the economist, said, something that can't go on forever won't. And this won't. We will obviously have to have some fairly significant changes along the way. Now, what is causing that, of course, is the fact that we are going to see something happen in the next 20 years that has never happened in American history before. This is the percentage of Americans over age 65. And you go back to 1950 through 1970, there's a steady growth, and then you get to the corresponding depression years, now as people reach 65, and it actually comes down. And that's what we have been seeing. But starting in 2008, something is going to happen that has never happened in American history before. And that is the percentage of Americans over 65 is going to double in a 20-year period. Those are the baby boomers. Now, again, this might not be exactly accurate, projecting that far out, but we're pretty sure because all those people have been born. All of those people are here. All right. This is why. Lifespans have increased dramatically in developed and developing countries. The blue bar represents life expectancy in 1950 to 1955, in that five-year period. The red bar represents life expectancy now, 2000 to 2005. So you've got a 50-year gap. Russia, not much change. India, the life expectancy has gone up dramatically. China, the life expectancy has gone up dramatically. In the United States, it's gone up from 68 to 77. That's what's producing the bulge that we saw. UK from 69 to 78. Germany, 67 to 78. France, 66 to 79. And the winner is Japan, that's gone from 63.9 to 81.9. So what we have seen in the charts I showed you of the impact on the American budget as the population has gotten older and the demands in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid have gotten higher as a percentage of everything is true in all of these other countries as well. This is a worldwide phenomenon. To put it in another context, at the beginning of the 20th century, in 1900, the world had 1.6 billion people. At the end of the century, it had 6.2 billion people. The world population more than tripled in a single century. And that's due not to a rising birth rate. As a matter of fact, as we shall see, the birth rate actually fell during the last century. It's because of a declining death rate. Whether it's health care or better nutrition or whatever it might be, the death rate in the last century declined more dramatically than at any time in the world's history, and the world has never seen a population growth even approaching what we've had. In a 100-year period, even with all of the disaster of the Second World War, the First World War, the starvation of all the kulaks in the Soviet Union, and the slaughters that occurred in China and everywhere else, even with all of that disaster, the world population more than tripled in a 100-year period, and you're seeing that shown up here country by country. In 1950, this was how the world population broke down on a percentage basis. 54% in Asia, 9% in Africa, Oceania 1%, North America 7%, and Latin America 7%, and Europe was 22%. That was 50 years ago. Now, Asia has grown to 60%. Africa has grown to 13%. Oceania stays stable at 1. North America, 7. Gone from 7 to 5. Latin America is at 9. And Europe has shrunk from 22% of the world's population to 12. 50 years from now, Asia will have come down to 57% because the growth is in Africa. Africa, 21%. Oceania, rocking along at 1%. North America, stable at 5%. Latin America, grown a little. And Europe is now only 7% of the world's population. That's why my friends in Europe were a little bit startled when they realized what was going to happen. The European Union is now the largest single integrated market in the world. In about 40 years, that won't be true. The European Union will have fewer people in it than the United States will. All right? Let's look at it from another point of view that I find interesting. If we take the 12 largest countries in the world, ranked by their population, at the end of the Second World War, interestingly enough, the list includes all of the major combatants in the Second World War. The three defeated nations, Germany, Japan, and Italy, and the five victors who gave themselves permanent seats in the Security Council, China, the United States, the Soviet Union, it's up there as Russia, United Kingdom, and France. The Second World War was fought between the world's largest countries. All right? Now, half a century later, I've highlighted the United Kingdom, Italy, and France in red on the first list because they're not on the second. They have dropped off from being in the top 12. And China is still number one, followed by India, the United States. Indonesia has moved up from sixth to fourth. Brazil from eighth to fifth. Russia has dropped to sixth. And Pakistan is on the list for the first time. Bangladesh has gone up. Japan has slipped down. Nigeria and Mexico are on the list for the first time. And Germany's at the bottom, so you see what's going to happen when we go out 50 years from now, listing the people who participated in the Second World War. Now the Russians and the Japanese and the Germans are all off the list, and therefore shown in red in the other one. And India has replaced China as the world's largest country. The United States still third, followed by Pakistan, Indonesia, Nigeria, Bangladesh, Brazil, Congo, Ethiopia, Mexico, and the Philippines. Now, another caveat here. This is assuming no pandemic. This is assuming that there will not be devastation of the populations in these countries, whether it be AIDS or tuberculosis or malaria or what it might be. So, once again, we can't be sure of this, but taking present demographic trends and putting them forward in 50 years, that's the kind of a world you're going to see in terms of the ranking of nations. Now, let's look at fertility rates in the countries that we are interested in. The horizontal bar is replacement rate. That is 2.1 children for every woman in the society. And if you have 2.1 births for every woman, you will have a stable population. It will neither grow nor shrink. That is replacement rate. Again, the blue bars are 1950, 1955. So that's that five-year period. They didn't just take 1 year to get it. They averaged it out over. So 50 years ago. And the red bars are now, 2000 to 2005, that five-year period. Okay, in Germany, they were above replacement rate. Now they're down below at 1.3. Japan, They were above replacement rate. They're down at 1.3. Russia, 1.3. Picking up a pattern here. United Kingdom, just barely above. They haven't fallen as far, but they're below replacement rate at 1.7. China, they were having tremendous births 50 years ago. They now have the one-child policy, and they have fallen below replacement rate, with China at 1.7. France, from 2.7 down to 1.9. The United States, 50 years ago, there were 3.5 births for every woman. Now it is 2, just under replacement rate. And India is the only one whose current birth rate is above replacement rate, but it has come down from 6 to 3. Now, the next chart will show you, well, let's go to it. There are only two countries, that means in 50 years, there are only two countries whose populations will still be growing, India and the United States. And you say, well, why will the United States still be growing if the birth rate is under 2.1? It's at 2.0. And the answer is immigration. We are assuming that the levels of immigration that America has historically had will continue, which means America will continue to have a growing population 50 years from now. This is one factor in the immigration debate that never gets brought up, but that I think is very, very important. If we do indeed do what some people want us to do and build a Berlin Wall around the United States and not let anybody in, it will not only have economic and social consequences, it will have demographic consequences. Because all of the other countries that you see on the list, Japan, Russia, France, Germany, and the UK, and China, 50 years from now, we'll see their population shrinking in size. The Chinese, of course, have the one-child policy, and it has some very interesting implications, which I will get into in just a moment. But if you stop and think about it, and the Chinese are beginning to, they realize that with a one-child policy, they are looking at what they call, I heard it when I was in China last, the 1-2-4 pyramid. One worker supporting 2 aged parents and 4 ancient grandparents. That has all kinds of challenging economic implications. All right. In that situation, the size of the working force assumed for this purpose to be people between the ages of 15 to 64, the size of the working age population will shrink dramatically in the rapidly aging countries. It'll go up in India, and it will go up in the United States. Just barely hold its own in the United Kingdom, but the percentage of the population available to work in France will shrink 9%, China 10%, Germany 19%, Japan 33%, and Russia 34%. The Russians are facing a very serious demographic crisis, which is why President Putin is now proposing a subsidy for women who have children. There is now an official economic attraction, economic incentive in Russia for you to have a child. This one is one I want to spend a little time on. These are current numbers. That is, the percentage, or the number of male to female. In India, right now, there are 106 males for every 100 females. In China, there are 106 males, 106.2. All of the other countries, the women are the majority of the population. And you get to Russia, the women are really the majority. There are only 86 men for every 100 women in Russia. But these statistics hide a trend. I'll pick China to illustrate it, but it is happening in some other countries. China, as I say, has the one-child policy, and if you are parents in China, and you're only allowed by government order to have one child, what sex do you want the child to be? You want it to be male because he is likely to be able to support you in the 1-2-4 pyramid. The female will get married off and be part of the support system for her husband's family. In villages in China where there are almost no modern services at all, there are sonograms. And when the woman becomes pregnant, she goes and gets a sonogram, and if it's female, she has an abortion and tries again until she has a boy. Hidden in that figure of 1.6, which is the current balance in China, is the figure of the cohort of young people coming along. And there, we can't be entirely sure of the numbers, but it's in this neighborhood of 120 boys to 100 girls. Historically, that kind of imbalance of that many more males than females has led to war. They invade other countries to try to get the women that they need. That means there are, for every 100 young men that find brides in China, there are going to be 20 who can't. The kidnapping of young women in China has already started. The implications for the setting up of brothels and sex workers to try to satisfy this demand seems improper to talk about these kinds of things in terms of supply and demand, but the supply is not there, the demand is, and the social implications of that kind of imbalance are extremely significant. And it's showing up in India, and we go back to this chart, Pakistan and Bangladesh. There are cultural reasons why they want sons rather than daughters. And if you look at that chart of the 20 largest countries in the world 50 years from now, you're going to have a significant social problem relating to the fact that there will not be enough women for the men as they become of marriageable age in four of the 12 largest countries in the world. And if you cut it off and say four of the top seven, including the top two, India and China, followed by Pakistan and Bangladesh. The implications of that have given rise to a number of sociological studies. We are still not quite sure how it's going to work. I'm not sure it will, in fact, produce war, as it has historically. The best example, of course, are the Romans who carried off all the Sabine women. But the pressures that will be created by that situation in the world will have all kinds of geopolitical and economic consequences that we can only guess at this point. There's a book out called Bare Branches, referring to these boys that have no prospects of having a posterity themselves. And they chose the metaphor bare branches because they say bare branches by themselves don't cause any problem, but when a spark hits them, they flare up into a conflagration. That's one of the demographic consequences that we have to keep our eyes on. All right. Oh, I went to. Here we go. Let's go back. Okay. Old age dependency ratios. This is the number of dependents per 100 persons of working age. Again, the working age is described as being from 15 to 64. And the various countries are, again, there. You can't see them from there, so I'll just tell you that top line in green is Japan. And the projection is that by 2050, there will be 70 old age dependents for every 100 people in Japan. You see, all of them started out down below 20. The United States was below 10. There were less than 10 old age dependents for every person of working age in the United States back in 1950. The United States comes out, it's the orange in the middle, it comes out just over 30. The dotted line is the world as a whole. And the blue at the bottom, below the world as a whole, the light blue, is India. And again, giving the age of India right now, they would be below. But you see the developed countries, the pink that's there below Japan is Europe as a whole. And then you have individual countries in Europe. As I say, the orange is the United States. The yellow that is just above the United States is Russia. And the black is China. So Japan, Europe as a whole, China, Russia, the United States, the world as a whole, and India. What are the implications of that when you have all of those old age dependents? All right, but the United States will still, as the previous chart indicates, remain one of the youngest of nations, once again, because of our immigration. Immigrants tend to come in at a young age. Okay, India will be the youngest. It'll go from the folks of retirement age will go from 7.9% to 20. The United States will go from 16 to 26. The UK up to 29. China, older. Russia, older still. France, older still. Germany, and again, the winner is Japan. Up there at 41% of their population will be over that age. Now, here's a chart, at least half a chart. See if we can get it to come up. There we go. Here's a chart that I throw in that you can't read what any of those things are, but let me tell them to you. To just give you a picture, I've taken two countries to talk about the traditional population pyramid. The traditional population pyramid says there are this many births as they die when they get older. It gets up, and finally at the top are the very old, so you have a pyramid with the new births at the bottom and the very old people at the top. Okay, this is the United States population by age right now. You see the baby boomers in there in the middle? We, on the right side of the chart are males, on the left side of the chart are females. What's that light purple bar at the top? 80 and above. You see the percent, the folks that are 80, just below that is 75 to 80, so on. If we draw 65, where we think of it as retirement age, all right, let's look at it in 50 years. That's an awful lot of 80-year-old women. But if you want to see something even scarier, this is China today. It's a more traditional population pyramid, but you're seeing the effects of the one child per family policy as the base of the pyramid shrinks. But there are not that many people over 80 in China. Just wait 50 years. There's China. Look at that tremendous number of old females. And yet, if you come below 80 and down into the lower areas, you see it's on the male side of the chart in just about every age cohort, raising the bare branches situation that I described. So here is the fundamental question. There are no numbers on the final pack chart. But coming back to the Americas, and at the same time, recognizing that every other developed country that has a Social Security, Medicare, social safety net for the aged kind of system is facing this same Pac-Man chart. how big is the mandatory going to be, and how much is going to be left for everything else? Defense, education, infrastructure, energy, environmental, income support, homeland security, disaster assistance, and whatever else we might think of. Okay, what does all this mean? It means a number of fundamental things. First and foremost, it means we have to rethink some of our present assumptions. If you have a shrinking workforce of the kind this describes, and there's nothing you can do about it in terms of the reality of the ages, you have to rethink the retirement age. You can increase the size of your working age population by definition. If you say 65 is no longer retirement age, it's now 75, you have just added a significant percentage of your population to the working age. And I am doing my part. I asked the people of Utah for a 6-year extension on my contract when I was 71. And they gave it to me. And I'm doing my part by staying in the working population. The challenges of that, of course, have to do with the kinds of jobs we do. I can be a senator without having any particular wear and tear other than the fact that I live with permanent jet lag. But if you're loading goods on a loading dock and earning your living with your muscle, saying, well, you need to work well past 65 for the good of the nation as a whole, that's a little hard to enforce. And all of this should come into the mix that we have been discussing here at Aspen about skill level, kinds of jobs. If you're designing software for Microsoft at $120,000 a year, you can probably stay on the job fairly well past 65. If you are in a physical labor kind of job, you probably can't. And that will exacerbate the kind of thing that Alan Greenspan talked about yesterday when he said the income level or the wealth disparity is really a skill disparity. We have a shortage of people for the high-paying jobs, which is why they are high-paying. The law of supply and demand says those people who have the necessary skills in the information age can command a big salary because there's a shortage. There isn't enough supply to meet the demand. On the other end of it, there is too great a supply of unskilled or semi-skilled too small a demand. And if we change the working age situation, we exacerbate that. On the other hand, if we say things stay pretty much the same for people who do manual labor, and we put the emphasis on the folks who are in the service industry and the knowledge industry, adding them to the workforce has a beneficial effect of increasing the supply of those kinds of workers and thereby having an impact on the disparity, the income disparity and the wealth disparity between the two groups. The other thing, of course, that we must do, we must slow the growth of the entitlements. We've got to slow the growth of the red, which means taking on the third rails of American politics, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And in the last panel I was in, I unburdened myself as to the many myriad ways in which we must completely restructure Medicare. Medicare is the biggest driver here. If I may, I have a solution to the Social Security problem. And the Social Security Trust Fund trustees have now scored it and says it solves 100% of the problem, and no, it doesn't have personal accounts in it. And when I talk to my Democratic friends in the Congress about can't we at least do Social Security, Social Security is the easy one. We can solve the Social Security problem moving numbers around. And I say, can't we get together and do this? They say, we'll talk to you after the next election. And the trouble with that is the next election never comes. But these numbers are going to drive us to a Social Security solution, and the impact of the Social Security on the red part of the Pac-Man chart, that one's the easy one that we can get a handle on. Everybody is going to have to recognize that something very fundamental in restructuring of medical care in this country to lower the costs and bring down the growth rate, or we're facing a demographic disaster that will engulf us all. And we cannot look to any of the other countries in the world as a model, because demographically, they're all going to be worse off than we. And on that happy note, I send you out to hear President Clinton solve all of our problems. Thank you very much.